The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, and Chicago. And if you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Leeds.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Leeds, along with Tim McKenna.
Hello, Diane.
Hello, Tim. How's Tim?
Fantastic.
Did you have a good week?
It was a lovely week.
It's been a busy week, especially in the bicycle world.
In all world, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's true. The whole world's sort of upside down. The Tour de France has had more twists and turns than a Cedar Point roller coaster.
Yeah, a little crazy this year.
A little crazy. And then we have the ex-cop, who thought her cute videos about running down and killing cyclists was just too funny. Did you see it?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, that news was pretty interesting. Man, she got slammed quick.
And she should have.
Yeah, she sure should. I don't know if you saw it, but ESPN aired one of its 30 on 30 documentary movies this week.
I did not see it, but I know what you're talking about.
It was based on Richard Moore's book, Slaying the Badger, which told the story of the 1986 Tour de France and Greg LeMond's win over the Badger Bernardinot, making LeMond the first and so far only American Tour de France winner. Brian came away from the documentary, ready for this, being reminded why he loves classic steel bicycles.
And why is that?
He was like drooling. Well, yeah. Because that's what they rode then.
Right. They rode.
These gorgeous bikes. And they were gorgeous. But if you have a chance to see it, ESPN, 30 on 30, evidently they're doing 30 documentaries by 30 different directors based on 30 different stories. And it was pretty good. I don't know if you do not have ESPN, how you might get it. But
actually, if you go to their site, if you just search for it, you can get it. You can actually get it through iTunes.
Oh.
There is a small fee for it at this time, but it is available for anybody that wants to see.
And I would say that if you did not read Slaying the Badger, which was really an excellent book, and in fact, Richard Moore's new book, Étape, is on my desktop waiting to be interviewed and reviewed. So he's a good writer. I like his stuff. We have quite a show for you this evening. Let's get to it. As promised, we will check in with Secretary of Transportation Anthony Fox. Another short-term stopgap transportation package sort of got eked through Congress right before they leave for their summer break. And also this week, a new issue of the NHTSA's Safety in Numbers report, which comes out of the Department of Transportation, talks about cycling. And some of those numbers are kind of scary, like 88% of those killed and 80% of those injured were male. And 48% of the bicycle deaths occurred between 4 p.m. and midnight. I thought that was kind of an interesting statistic. And ready for this one? This is my least favorite, but it's sort of a duh statistic. 24% of bicyclists killed had blood alcohol levels of 0.08 or higher. Why are people riding and drinking, or drinking and riding?
Get up and ride at 4:30 or 5 in the morning. That solves two problems.
It's before the prime time, and you probably haven't started drinking yet, we hope. Anyway, we'll ask the Secretary what he thinks Congress might do, if at all, to alleviate the transportation bill logjam, and what he thinks we can do to help prevent some of the two-wheeled tragedies outlined in this latest report. This past Monday, by the way, a group of women cyclists left downtown Cleveland for an 11-day adventure around Lake Erie. I wanted to know more about it, so I decided we might as well go right to the source and check in with Women Tours owner Jackie Marchand to talk about the Circle Lake Erie Tour, one in a series that will eventually cover all five of the U.S. Great Lakes, and my friend Cheryl is on this tour. Then we're going to talk about stolen bikes.
Everybody's had one.
I was just going to say, have you ever had a bike stolen? It's really a nasty feeling, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. Well, Brian Hance wanted to do something about it, and he's created some registration possibilities and some Twitter possibilities that will recover bikes by tweeting serial numbers. It's kind of interesting. What do you hear about this? And how I found Brian Hans? It's because he does some statistical work for our radio station right here.
Really?
Yes, it's called Small World Syndrome.
Yes.
So he's going to talk with us in the second half of the show. And then my final guest this evening is 16.
Is he a cyclist of some sort, a racer? Or
would you believe he's a journalist?
Okay.
Luke Ellingham. I don't often get to speak with young journalists, but his coverage of races, teams, and riders in the pro peloton is pretty impressive. In 2009, his older two brothers and his father were watching riders race up Mont Ventoux during the Tour de France. Luke got sucked into bike racing, and wait till you hear who he's been able to interview and what he's doing this year. I was just blown away. I'm like, wait a minute. This kid is like, I don't even want to tell you how many generations younger than me. So we have a full show. The whole hour is going to be taken up. We might actually have a little bit of time for news. We have a few news items that we'd really like to get to. So let's run down to Washington, D.C., and we're going to speak with Secretary of Transportation Anthony Fox. Mr. Secretary, thanks for joining me on the show.
Great to talk to you, Diane.
I want to get right to the situation of the Transportation Department finding itself again with no transportation bill. So tell us what happened in Congress. There was a stopgap measure this week.
Yeah, it's the 19th patch in the last 5 or 6 years, Diane. Congress can't seem to find its way to a long-term bill, which we badly need in transportation, because the reality is that projects in transportation take many times, you know, 2 to 3 years to get done. And with 10 months of funding, which is what they're talking about now, it's very hard to plan those projects at the state and local level. So we're going to be kind of stuck in neutral until Congress gets a long-term bill done, and we're doing everything we can to push them towards the Grow America Act, which is the administration proposal.
And is there a possibility that that will actually come to the floor anytime in the next, you know, millennia or so?
I hope so. You know, it's 1 yard in a cloud of dust most days on this issue. You know, look, the reality is the American people have the power. They're the ones who are in charge. And this is not a partisan issue. It's not a Republican or Democratic issue. There are no Republican or Democratic roads or bridges or highways or bike lanes. They're the ones that everyone uses. And what the American people are going to have to impress upon their members of Congress is that this is an issue that they need to solve, that Americans are willing to contribute towards getting a better infrastructure system so that our kids can have a better environment to grow up in than we did.
Well, you know, you spoke before the National Bike Summit, and you said that our roads should be safe, that they should be easy places to travel no matter how we're traveling on them. And now I know you come from North Carolina, and you did some great things for complete streets and safe routes to school. Where are those programs? Are they still in existence in the transportation bill?
Well, yeah, our proposal would, you know, would greatly grow the Tiger program, which we've used to great effect to increase accessibility of bike lanes and complete streets projects around the country. But one of the things that we're doing as a department is we're also looking at everything we do. Highway dollars to the tune of $40 billion get spent every single year, and there's no reason in the world that we couldn't continue encouraging states and local communities to adopt complete streets policies, to include bike lanes as part of their road infrastructure, so that folks can have a dedicated place on the roadways to operate their bicycles.
Well, we're going to take a sort of a left turn here or a right turn and talk about a newsletter that came out this week from the National Highway Transportation. Is that right? NHTSA?
That's right.
Yeah. And it's called Safety in Numbers, and it actually addresses a lot of things about cyclists. And I got this a little bit late, so I was just going over it. 88% of the bicyclists killed and 80% of those injured were male. Kind of a scary figure. But tell us a little bit about this particular release this week of this newsletter.
One of my priorities as secretary is to ensure that bicycling and pedestrians both get treated with the same level of safety as any other way of moving around whether automobile, airplane, or what have you. And this release is one of the first efforts we've taken to put out hard information on the state of bicycling in the country. I can tell you from experience, because I do like to get on my bicycle from time to time, that it can be challenging out there on the roadways. And so the more information we provide to the traveling public, not only bicyclists but also drivers, will be helpful to us in improving our safety record.
Well, this is an interesting report, and it makes a lot of sense in a lot of ways, including a section that's top mistakes that bicyclists make and top mistakes that drivers make. How did this report get compiled, and where does it come from in terms of time? How long ago were these statistics gathered? Was this fairly recent?
Yeah, this is fairly recent. We asked our National Highway Traffic Administration, Safety Administration, to put this information together. It really is a compilation of data that we've received. I think some of it comes from 2002, some of it from 2013. There may be some longer look-backs in it, but it's really trying to provide people with a thumbnail of basically the safety situation with bicycling across the country. We identify, for example, the top five states with safety challenges when it comes to bicycling, and then the states that have the lowest challenges with safety in bicycling. It doesn't mean that nobody can improve. I think everyone can, but it's just a way of giving folks kind of a thumbnail sketch of where we are, and we hope to, frankly, improve our ability to track data on bicycling over time. We hope to, again, encourage the investment in bike lanes and other facilities that are needed to improve safety. And quite frankly, you spoke about North Carolina. One of the troubling things that's happening in North Carolina right now is that there's a discussion about reducing the investment in driver's education, which I think is a real opportunity. Driver's education is a real opportunity to help educate drivers not only about how to drive, but also about being careful with other vehicles on the road, including bicycles. And reducing driver's education generates a lot of concern about whether we're going to be as safe as we could be.
What an interesting point, because I think education at a young age for both bicyclists and drivers could all be done at one time, that, you know, those rules of the road really don't change a whole lot between a bicyclist and a driver. We're all vehicles, and if drivers were more aware of cyclists and cyclists were completely aware of what their rules and regulations are, you know, at that early age, maybe more would be encouraged to ride bicycles and less to drive cars.
That's right. And by the way, we're seeing more and more people using bicycles. And I don't think that trend is going to abate anytime soon. So, a robust driver's education program should include education about bicycling and other modes of transportation.
Well, the last question I have for you is, as this transportation bill keeps getting kicked around, what can my listeners do to let their wants be known to their legislators? I mean, what would you recommend? How should they let them know that this is an important issue for them, transportation?
I really appreciate that question. You know, I think many people out there underestimate the power of picking up the phone and calling a member of Congress and telling them what you think. And we need more and more people doing that on this issue. And urge your members of Congress to have an affirmative opinion on how we're going to get ourselves out of this transportation ditch the country's in.
Well, I appreciate you taking time today. I know you are very busy, and I hope you have a wonderful weekend.
Diane, thank you. Great to be with you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Secretary Anthony Fox joined me from his office in Washington, D.C.
I think it's good to see that we still have cycling as a priority.
When he was the mayor of Charlotte, he did a lot of stuff that evidently worked for cycling. I mean, he really did do the complete streets down there and the safe routes to school and all those cool things. I have seen pictures of him with a helmet on and riding a bike. I know he addressed the National Bike Summit. And it's nice to finally get to talk to him. You know, I have never spoken with this secretary. We did speak with Secretary LaHood several times. So it's nice to get to know Anthony Fox, and I appreciate him being on the show.
And everyone needs to understand that it is important at the national level. While we do accomplish a lot of things for cycling at the local level, coming from the national level, anything that comes down from there is so important.
Yep. We're going to take a real quick break. We'll be right back and speak with Jackie Marchand. She is the head of Woman Tours. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Jackie, welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. I wanted to talk to you today because there's a really special tour that began right here in downtown Cleveland this week.
Yes, there is.
Tell us about it.
It's a tour that goes all the way around Lake Erie, and it starts and ends in Cleveland.
Yay! Right here downtown. And I was not able to go to the start. It was on Monday. But my friend Cheryl, who was on the show last time you were on the show, is on that tour.
That's right.
Yeah. So how many days is it going to take?
It is going to take 14 days, 2 weeks.
Nice. How many women are doing this tour?
We have 26 women this year.
Wow.
Yeah. It's pretty exciting.
That is exciting. So explain why you chose Lake Erie, and I think it's one of a series of rides you're going to do.
Yes, it is. This is the third in the series. We're going to go around all of the Great Lakes. We started with Ontario, and we did Superior a couple of years ago, and this year we set out to do Lake Erie.
How many miles a day approximately will these ladies be touring?
We average 50 miles a day.
Nice.
And there's one layover day in Buffalo, so they can go up and check out Niagara Falls if they haven't seen it yet.
Okay.
But every other day, they cycle.
Nice. Now, are they staying in, like, B&Bs or hotels, or where are accommodations on this tour?
They actually stay in hotels, mostly chain hotels, you know, Hampton Inns, Holiday Inns, things like that.
Yeah, but they have hot showers, beds, and pools usually.
They sure do, and we cook for them. We cook every night, and we all eat outside in the parking lot. It doesn't sound very glamorous, but the food is excellent.
I think it's wonderful. So when I looked at your website, it seems that you're offering more tours than ever.
We are. We've been really fortunate. We grow every year. We've been able to expand the variety of tours. Most of our women come back year after year after year, and they bring their friends. So we keep growing because of that, and we're able to offer bike path tours, road tours, everything from 4 days to 2 months long.
So you do have a cross-country tour?
We do. We go from California to Florida in April and May, and it takes March and April, and it takes us 2 months to do it.
Nice. So what's the average age of the woman who comes on your tour? You must do some demographic. I'm sure you do a lot, actually.
We do. And the average age is 56.
Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And the average age, if you were to look at the women on a Lake Erie tour, for example, it tends to skew a little higher. It's actually about 61.
Why do you think that is?
Well, the Lake Erie tour is a little bit longer, and our cross-country tour, the one that goes from California to Florida, that's 2 months long, you have to be at a certain time of your life that you can take that amount of time off from your life. Either you have a sabbatical that you've earned, or you're retired, or you have your own business and are finally in a place where you can take that kind of time off and leave your responsibilities to someone else.
The name, of course, explains exactly what this is about. It's Women Tours, Woman Tours. So why do women prefer to travel with other women as opposed to in mixed company? And do you have any response to that you know, I might be able to understand?
Well, I should say that some women prefer to travel. Not everybody. You know, if you have a husband or a spouse or a son or something that loves to bike and bikes the same pace with you, then you're in luck. But a lot of women don't. They bike by themselves when they're home, and they love to have the camaraderie of other people who bike at the same speed and have the same abilities and and interest that they do.
Very interesting. That, of course, not thinking outside the box because, I've always, most of my business is men. That's just the way the bicycle world is. But
yeah.
You get to see that smaller percentage, which is growing. And are you, obviously, you're seeing that that's true. Your tours are all growing.
Yes, they are growing.
That's awesome. What are your most popular tours this year? Which ones just like sold out before you could barely get them up on the site?
Well, the Southern Tier was completely full this year. That's the one from California to Florida.
Wow.
Lake Erie was also, we had a lot of women. Our average tour is about 14 people. So we had double that, nearly double on the Erie, and double that on the Southern Tier this year.
What new tours do you have besides Erie? You're not going to do Erie again next year, I take it.
Actually, we will.
Oh, will you?
It is back on the schedule.
Oh, cool.
We took Ontario off. We do run, because we do have so many returning guests, we run our tours through kind of a rotation. We put new ones on every year. Some new ones next year is a bike and barge trip in Italy.
Ooh,
that's
my hands up on that one.
Yeah, that's proving to be very popular.
I'll bet.
We also go to Ireland. Our Moab tour in Utah is also one of our more popular trips.
When somebody signs up for one of these tours, what kind of departure guide would somebody get? So I sign up for your Moab trip. You're going to send me some stuff. What is it that you're sending me that would help me get ready for your tour?
We try to send all the information that you would need to get ready. We know that a lot of women haven't traveled on their own before they come with us. So we give them all the information about how to get to and from the trip. We enclose a optional training schedule. We always say it's optional. Some women follow it to a T, and some women never even notice it, and both are welcome on the trip. We also have travel insurance is available. We always recommend that because a lot can happen between the time you sign up for the trip and when you actually go for the trip. We try to really anticipate any question that people have and answer it right away.
How many guides usually go with each of your tours?
Each of our tours has two guides on it, and one of those guides always rides last. So no one is ever the slowest rider. It's always one of our guides.
That's pretty cool. Are those guides in addition to who's driving SAG?
Well, we run two different kinds of tours, and the Around Lake Erie is one of our epic tours. And then we do have a second SAG vehicle for that trip, and that is run by three volunteer guests. They switch off driving every third day, and then the other days they ride their bicycles like everybody else.
Very organized, I must say. Very organized. Very organized. Well, so when are we expecting the ladies back in Cleveland? Maybe, we'll go down and meet them and maybe try and do an on-the-street interview.
Oh, that would be so fun.
Wouldn't that be fun?
That would be
fun.
Yeah.
When are they due back?
They are due back on the 2nd.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we will mark that. So let our listeners know how they can find out more about Woman Tours.
Well, they can check our website at Woman Tours. WOMANTOURS.com. We're also on Facebook and Instagram, and you can always give us a call at 800-247-1444.
That's easy enough. Well, that's awesome, and I'm really pleased to speak with you again. It's always nice to catch up with another woman who's in the bicycle world. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. Have a good night.
Bye-bye, Diane.
Bye-bye. Jackie Marchand joined me from New York.
It's great to see that they're going all the way around Lake Erie, and I was surprised to see 26 women.
Yeah, and, when I talked to Cheryl, the last time I saw Cheryl, before she left, she was in yoga, of course, and we talked about the tour, and I thought she said 11 days. I guess not. It's 14, so it's 2 weeks. That's cool.
Yeah, that would be cool. A neat trip.
She was worried about riding 50 miles a day, but she'll be fine. She'll be fine.
She can do yoga. She can do 50 miles a day.
People don't understand that you have all day and all you are required to do is get up and ride. Everything else is taken care of for you. So if you rode 10 miles an hour, it would take you 5 hours to ride 50 miles.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
And you can stop and you can smell the roses and all that. All right. We're going to take a break. We will be right back. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees.
And I'm Tim McKenna.
I think we should do some news. What do you think?
Absolutely.
All right, go for it.
I just want to send a little bit of a congratulations out to one of our previous guests, Dr. Eric Barcott, who is now the U.S. Pro Champion. So he got his new threads. He got to wear them for the first time.
Yep, yeah.
The Stars and Stripes. And he actually won two stages at the Cascade Classic. So congratulations to him. He's doing well with the new threads.
Very nice. It's always nice to see the Stars and Stripes. Well, I don't like starting with bad news, but I do have bad news. For those of you who knew him or his work, the bike community and the frame builders community lost a good one this week. Tom Teasdale was riding Ragbri when he suffered a medical emergency, and the Des Moines Register has had a Ragbri report every day. Try to say that several times. But this comes from the Tuesday, July 22nd report, and it's kind of an interesting one. It's titled Rider Who Died of Heart Attack, so they do know now that it was a heart attack. They had medical people there instantly, from what I understand. I mean, instantly. He was one of Iowa's, quote, secret famous people, end quote. Somewhere in Tom Teasdale's West Branch shop sits a steel bike frame never to be finished. Teasdale died Monday after he suffered a heart attack while riding the Register's annual Great Bicycle Ride across Iowa, his son said. Teasdale, 62, of West Branch, was known in the international biking community for his custom frame designs, especially for mountain bikes. For 38 years, Teasdale owned and operated TET Cycles out of a warehouse in West Branch where he sold custom bikes, including cyclocross, mountain, road, and tandem. Steve McGuire, a University of Iowa professor of 3D design and metal arts, said Teasdale's son called him to tell him about the death. McGuire said Teasdale would often build custom bikes for special needs students at Camp Courageous in eastern Iowa and would ride tandem alongside them when they needed a partner. He had an engineer's mind and the generosity of a pope, said McGuire. Son John Teasdale said his father loved his family and had a passion for bicycles. It's nice. Well, it's not nice. But if you've got to go out, you might as well go out riding your bike, he said. Ragbri Medical Director Bob Libby said a quick response motorcycle and ambulance tried to help Teasdale on Monday morning between Terrell and Greithinger in northwest Iowa. He later died at Palo Alto County Hospital in Emmitsburg. So, a tip of the helmet to Tom Teasdale. And for those of you who have his frames, lucky you. Lucky you.
As we're starting to see more and more electric bicycles or hybrids, I actually have new regulations that will take place on September 1st. And this, surprisingly, comes from the Jerusalem Post.
Okay. Did anybody realize there's sort of a war going on in Israel right now?
Yeah, that's kind of what surprised me, and that's why it caught my attention. But as of September 1st, for riding electrical bicycles, they will be permitted to have a maximum power level of 250 watts and a travel speed not exceeding 25 kilometers per hour.
Did you know that Dallas has a new bicycle czar?
No.
Yes, and she...
She?
I think she's a PhD, because somebody said something about its doctor. Yes. Her name is Ashley Hare. She is Dallas's new bike coordinator, takes over control of the city's bike plans at a critical time. Yeah, everywhere. We can all use somebody like that. City leaders are eager to boost Big D's cycling options and are looking at initiatives including more bike lanes, off-street trails, bike sharing programs, and increased awareness about how bikes and cars should share the road. Hare is already deep into plans for bike lanes in a few new areas. This was written by Tom Benning at the Dallas News. It was published on the 19th of July. Ashley experienced the pros and cons of Dallas's cycling world all rolled into one biking down Main Street. The city's new bike coordinator wheeled through so-called sharrows, lanes marked for sharing by cars and bicycles, as well as a stretch of dedicated bike lanes. But the options changed from one block to the next, confusing both bikers and motorists. She pointed to two high-density neighborhoods, downtown and Deep Ellum, that are primed for bike culture to take hold. But she also lamented that riders would need to cross a major thoroughfare and go under two highways to get from downtown to Fair Park. And though Hare noted that Dallas residents are, by and large, bike-friendly, one driver squeezed past her by veering into a lane mostly filled with parked cars. Another sped past her on the wrong side of the road. Both cars ended up stopped at the next red light, just like Hare. So it's a nice article. It's nice to hear that Dallas is moving forward with their cycling programs. And welcome to the world, Ashley Hare. I hope you have a great time in Dallas.
Sunday is the final day of the tour. But very first thing in the morning, we have La Course, which is the women's race.
Yes, we do.
So, for everybody to get a quick update on what they need, I found a great article at prowomencycling.com.
There you go.
If you go to the website, it will have links there for the women that are racing. It will have the course, which is relatively straightforward, but it also has a link to some of the places that you can watch it. So, Eastern Standard Time here in the United States, it's going to start at 6:30 in the morning. So, you can go ahead and watch it there. And it has just some small bits about who to follow on Twitter and everything else that's there. So hopefully this is a great start with La Course, and next year maybe we'll see several other stages instead of just a single day event. Do you think anyone will be able to meet Miss Voss? Do you think anybody will be able to beat her?
I don't know. It's a good question, but we'll see. You know, there are a couple people who beat her in a couple of stages in the Giro Rosa, but nah, she's a tough one. My guess is no.
I think the biggest challenge anyone has against her is it's a one-day event. It's
right.
It's quick,
and
it's simple.
She's really unbeatable.
There are
in that
a lot
regard.
Of women to watch, but I think the challenge is because it's one day, it'll be difficult.
Okay. My video of the week.
Yes.
Forget the woman who ended up getting fired who resigned. Sorry. She did not get fired. I stand corrected. She resigned from the Santa Paula Police Department for her ridiculous rant on cyclists. But at any rate, this is my video of the week, and I titled it Tour de France Weirdness. Thomas Vogler stopped mid-race this week and abused Dutch fans after being booed in the Tour de France this year. It is a YouTube video. It is hilarious, except I don't understand a word of Dutch, so I have no idea what he was saying, but he stopped. He literally stood over his bike and started yelling at some people on the side of the road, got back on his bike and kept riding. I think if you just typed in Thomas Vogler and then abuses Dutch fans, the YouTube will come right up. It's pretty funny.
That's one of the things that we've talked about over this year so far is use of GoPro cameras. And I know they're talking about more and more of those for the tour next year.
Yeah, I know.
And
I don't know if I'm for it or against it. I'm not even sure. I'm sure I'm for the radio contact that they have.
Right. Well, I'm not for the radio contact. And when you go back to Slay the Badger and you look at how they raced, and again, we talked about what beautiful steel frames they had,
right,
and you look at all the racing before that without the radios, I think I don't know, but I think we're going to see more and more of this where riders are going to stop, and we'll get to see that. I'm sure
right.
The TV cameras don't.
I think you're going to see a lot of things
of
maybe
it.
You don't want to see too.
I know that's I think that's what it gets to, but I think more insight will be good, and I'm sure there are a lot of riders that would love to do more than just stand there and yell at someone from Holland.
Well, I think on that note, we're going to head on out to Portland, Oregon, and we're going to learn if you get your bike stolen, maybe what you can do to get it back. As we talk with Brian Hance. Brian, thanks for joining me on the show this afternoon.
Oh, good afternoon. Thanks so much for having me.
Strange things happen when you're in the broadcasting business. You actually have a connection to our station here in John Carroll.
I do. I do indeed. I think they were my third customer. I have an online playlist software, and I lived in Cleveland for a number of years. And I think I've been with WJCU or vice versa for, I think, going on 5 or 6 years now.
Nice.
Yeah, it's funny. It's the smallest of worlds. It never ceases to amaze me.
Yeah, and then it was the Move by Bike piece that kind of got you. So there you have it. When you and I were corresponding about JCU and all of that, you mentioned that you're involved in recovering stolen bikes, and I want to know about that. So tell us a little bit about your background there and what you've done.
Some people have strange hobbies. I recover stolen bikes.
That's not strange.
Yeah, way back in the day, in the mid to late 90s, I was a student at the University of Arizona, and I was on my fifth or sixth stolen bike, and I was just blinded with rage, and I wanted to sort of channel that. I took a real hard look at the problem and talked to a lot of people, and it was such a no-brainer problem. It was such a ridiculous, a bike gets stolen, even if it has a serial number, it goes into a warehouse somewhere where nobody checks the serial number. The serial number is recorded in a database that nobody has access to. Or, you know, I talked to one cop who told me it sucks because the campus guys maintain their own database and it's pretty good, but then the city guys also maintain their own database and they don't talk to each other. So some guy could steal your bike and walk 50 feet into a different jurisdiction, and even if he got arrested in that jurisdiction, that you would never get your bike back to you. It just, there were all these sort of really obvious holes that me, you know, as a naive computer science kid, I took a look at this and said, you know, I can fix this. This is pretty easy. And that was right about the time that, you know, the web was already huge. Mobile was just sort of starting to come into being. A lot of, you know, phone applications and whatnot. So I built a website for finding stolen bikes. And the whole idea was, you know, your bike gets stolen, you fill out a police report, and that information sort of goes into a black hole. It doesn't go anywhere. So my idea was, let's take that information and let's give it to anybody and everybody who has a vested interest in helping people find stolen bikes. So let's make it as public as possible. Let's put it on the web and let's put it out in email lists. And, you know, now I send it out over Twitter, and basically let's get that information out to everybody, and let's do it in a really easy way, a really approachable, very, 10 seconds. You can check on a bike serial number now. Let's do that. So bike shops, bikers, cops, anybody who wants to sort of try to help fight bike theft, can do so. And, you know, I'm just some schmuck with a website. I'm not funded. I'm just some dude. And I just talked to a lot of people and wrote a website, and I got a bike back the first week. And you know, this is just dealing with maybe 50 or 60 people. And, you know, I got a bike back the next week, and I got hooked. And it's just, it has been one of those things that it's a lot of work, but it is so gratifying to get that needle out of that haystack. And I do it with quite decent regularity these days. It's still a long shot, but when we get them back, they're absolutely amazing stories.
Walk us through how it works. So I have a bike, I park it in front of my local coffee shop, I come out, it's gone.
Sure,
but
of course.
Of course, the first thing you have to do is know your serial number. That would be the first smart thing. Or do you register the bike ahead of time? Is there a way to register the bike ahead of time?
There is. And that's actually something recently. I partnered with another service quite recently, and that's was one of the big reasons why. I'll walk you through the process, and then I'll tell you a little bit about. So your bike gets stolen. Once you're done, you know, ranting and shouting at the sky and cursing the Cleveland bike thieves, of which I'm also intimately familiar.
That's right.
You sort of go through the motions. You can file a police report if you want to. Sometimes it's, you know, depending on jurisdictions, they won't even bother sometimes, depending on the value of the bicycle. You know, if it's covered under homeowners, if it's expensive enough, you can file an insurance claim, and that's it. I mean, you're sort of, unless you're extremely diligent, you can, you know, print up some flyers and you can take them to local bike shops. You do all these sort of basic things. You tell everyone, you know, you go on Facebook and you yell about it. And after that, you're kind of on your own. And it's really unfortunate. So what you can do now is you can register with me. I'm now at stolen.bikeindex.org. And we take pictures, we take serial number, we take color, we take descriptions. And most importantly, we take things like, you know, had a small scratch on the down tube, had a bike's not bomb sticker, all these sort of really weird, very personalized details that that people who are looking to identify stolen bikes can use. So what happens is that goes into a massive database that I run with my partner now, Seth Herr, who's in Chicago. He runs the Bike Index.
Okay.
And we take that information and we give it to anyone and everyone who comes calling for free. So we have a number of police departments that use our service because it frankly is quite better than the databases they are using. We have bike shops, we have bike mechanics, we have sort of middlemen reseller guys. We have a number of pawn shops, which is something I've been focusing on a lot lately. we have just a lot of everyday bikers like you and I, or people who may be trying to buy a bike off Craigslist, or, you know, somebody wakes up and there's a bike dumped in their front lawn, or someone, what happens often, it kicks a tenant out, a non-paying tenant out, and they realize that, you know, this house has been used as a chop shop and there's 50 bikes in the garage.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, there are so many scenarios, and it's hard to go into them all, but basically anybody and everybody who comes to me and says, hey, I want to know about a red Trek 7300 in the Cleveland area that's, you know, 56 centimeters, tell me. And we can say, here are all the red Trek 7600s we have on file. You know, do any of them look like they match the one you have? And a lot of the times they say, yeah, there's a sticker on it. And this guy has had a sticker too. And we put the two people in touch and the bike gets recovered.
That's a hell of a database.
There's almost 30,000 bikes in this database now. I've run it since the late 90s.
Goodness.
And I mean, the recoveries, again, I made the analogy earlier about needles and haystacks. The current record is 10 years and it went from Washington to North Carolina. I have a write-up about it on my website.
That sounds like a wonderful story.
It was a very specific Trek OCLV that this guy had stolen in a home break-in. And it popped up under weird circumstances in North Carolina. And this guy said, look, I don't want to go into the details, but I know this bike that this guy has is not a good bike. Can you tell me more? And it was the bike. Everything matched, from the dings to the serial to the model. And we wound up actually getting the police involved, because at that point, the guy who owned it had obviously obtained it under really shady circumstances and was not really cooperating.
I mean, I've recovered a few bikes for customers over the years. You know, somebody will call me, a bike shop gets a bike, and they'll call our shop and they'll say, you're the only ones in town who sold this brand. It must be in your database somewhere. And yeah, so we recovered a Calfee like that once. But yeah, but holy smokes, this is amazing. I'm speaking with Brian Hance. He's out in sweltering California, but he's really from Portland, Oregon. And we're talking about recovering stolen bikes, which this is just way cool, way cool. Tell me about the Twitter, is it stolen thing.
Yes. So I found Twitter is an excellent tool. Twitter's I am constantly blown away at the connections, with yourself included, for example, that I make.
There
on
we have it.
For many years, what I have done, I've run localized Twitter accounts. So, for example, if you get a bike stolen in San Francisco, when it is approved in my website, it gets tweeted out to Stolen Bikes SFO, which has a little over 1,000 followers at this point. So it's a great way to connect people in that very specific community in that town with a feed of all the stolen bikes that they can keep an eye out for.
Uh-huh.
So it was always sort of a one-way, and it works great. It is a great one-way sort of form of communication. So I recently, as I said earlier, partnered with Bike Index, who handles pre-registration as well. And he is an excellent coder, and his skills are definitely above mine. And we sort of got to talking. We said, man, you know, one of the biggest obstacles we have is, you know, we have a lot of bike shops that use our service, but it's really hard for a guy to, like, you know, write the serial number down, walk over to a computer, open up the browser, go to this website, type in. It's like a five or, you know, it takes a little while. So we built a Twitter bot called Is It Stolen that you can tweet a serial number to. And it will tweet you back if that bike is reported stolen in the Stolen Bike Registry /Bike Index. So if you tweet 12345 at Is It Stolen, and if someone has registered a bike or multiple bikes with that serial, it tweets you back and says, hey, not only do I have that on file, but here are pictures and here are links to that bike. So it becomes an incredibly fast way to check on a bike serial number that most people, you know, you're carrying around a phone in your pocket right now. You can do it in 10 seconds.
So have you decided whether or not you should make this into an app?
You know, we actually figured that the Twitter is actually more approachable than the app. There's a lot of advantages to having that Twitter back and forth out in the open. There's a lot of and I admit they're incredibly nerdy, sort of security related. But it's better if everyone is very open about, hey, I have this bike with this serial number, and a public reply. Yes, I know that bike is stolen, guy who just tweeted me. And now does everyone else who follows this feed
exactly.
Also
exactly.
So there's a number. I mean, an app would probably have its own advantages. But right now, Twitter, having that discourse public and having that discourse, there's a ton of advantages to it, because, you know, we're getting to the point that we can likely just, even if the person who signed up also has a Twitter handle, we can say, hey, at guy who asked, I have that bike on file and his name is at, you know, guy number two.
Sure.
And just connect the two individuals over Twitter. it's such an approachable medium, and it's such, I mean, there's such a low barrier to entry to Twitter, and it's so fast. It just, it has a number of advantages. But we do, I mean, that's not the only, it's not the only, the data is approachable in many ways. This Twitter bot is just sort of the recent toy that we rolled out.
Wow. Well, we only have a few more seconds, so tell us how to, A, register your bike with your system, and then, B, how to use Twitter with the system.
You can register your bike for free right now. We'll never spam you. We'll never sell your information. The only time we'll ever contact you is if someone shows up and is querying about your serial. Go to www.bikeindex.org. It's super easy. It's mobile-friendly. It takes about 2 minutes. You can do multiple bikes. Definitely, it's a great reason to just sort of sit down right now and record all your serial numbers should anything ever happen to the bike. And if you want to interact with our stolen bike Twitter bot, all you need to do is, if you ever have a question about a serial number, or say you're examining a bike and you want to know if it's stolen, all you need to do is flip that bike upside down, look at the serial number, and tweet that serial number to @isitstolen, just as it sounds, ISITSTOLEN. And the Twitter bot will run off and it will check and it will see if we have any reports of that bike being stolen. And if it knows anything about it, it'll tweet you right back and it'll let you know.
I just think this is awesome. And I think that this could really, hopefully enough people will be listening, that this could sort of revolutionize what happens with these people who think it's okay to steal a bike.
Yeah. And I will say the last 6 months, more people have come out of the woodwork, be it bikers or pro bike organizations, to cops, to campuses, to, as I said before, pawn shops. The interest in this is just going through the roof, and it makes me extremely happy because the more people use it, the better it works, and the more bikes we get back.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for talking with me. We will talk again sometime because obviously our paths are bound to cross again.
Yes, yes. It's bikeindex.org, and I'd be happy to talk to you anytime.
Thanks. Have a good evening.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Brian Hance joined me from California. What do you think? Isn't that cool?
Yeah, that's a great use of Twitter. I've actually been to the Is It Stolen Twitter account, and it's not very exciting. There's just a lot of, sorry, I couldn't find that bike in the index. So the bot actually works really well, but I did find one where someone actually got a reply back that there are 11 bikes with that serial number. So... But
that's interesting.
Really,
too.
This is a great use of the media, and it's simple, straightforward. The bikeindex.org website, very simple, easy to operate, and everybody should, you know, if they're interested in getting their bike back at some time, go to the website, and registering would be a good idea.
I think so, too. All right, we need to run on over to Chicago and talk with 16-year-old Luke Allingham, and we're going to hear from a professional journalist. I'm very excited. Luke, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
Thanks for having me.
It's not often I have the honor of speaking with a 16-year-old journalist. Makes me feel like I started a little late here, you know? Tell me about your background, how you got into writing about cycling.
Well, I've been watching cycling since like July of 2009. And then April of 2011, I had a Google News alert for the Leopard Trek team. And I got an email and it said, oh, you know, there's a site that it's a fan site for Leopard Trek. They are looking for volunteer writers. So I was like, all right, well, this might be fun. You know, haven't really done any writing before. Let me try it out. Let me see where it goes. So I sent them a sample article about a race that just happened, and they were like, the guy was really nice. He was like, oh yeah, you know, you can do some articles for us if you want, you know, no problem. We were looking for writers, so if you want to join, come on. And then from there, it's been 3.5 years now, so kind of progressing from there.
So you've been writing really since you were like 12 and a half?
Yes.
Wow. Wow, your skills must be exemplary for a young person.
I don't know about that, maybe, but you know, I think I just had some luck. But
Well, luck always helps, you know.
Yeah,
definitely. I agree. So you've interviewed some really interesting people like Taylor Finney and Levi Leipheimer and Jens Voigt and Chris Horner. How were you able to get interviews with each of these hotshots?
Well, for a guy like Taylor Finney, I was actually interviewed him at the U.S. Nationals in Chattanooga this year. So that was kind of a special situation because I was like, oh, okay, he's there, you know, day before the road race, you know, he happened to have free time. So he and I just kind of connected. But I mean, for guys like Horner and Leipheimer, those happened either via mutual friends of ours or in the case of Horner, just reaching out to him on Twitter and saying, you know, this is what I'm doing. I want to interview about your Volta win. You know, are you up for it?
And he said yes.
Yeah, he said,
I've tried that, and it's not working for me. Why is it working for you? Well, we don't have to go there.
It's a rough game.
It is a rough game. And I get my coups. Like this week, we have you're on the show with the Secretary of Transportation, so it's not all bad, you know.
No. I saw that. That's really awesome.
What kinds of questions are you asking people like Taylor and Levi and Jens and Chris?
I mean, it kind of varies. Like with Taylor, it was specifically focused on U.S. Nationals, and well, at the time, it was focused on his possible tour selection and that kind of stuff. But I mean, usually it's just about their careers, what's going on in their life. Specifically with Levi, it was like he had just retired, or he had just officially announced retirement. So it was majorly about that, and majorly about what he and his wife do in their spare time. And so it kind of varies. Usually it's just about, you know, race results, teams, their love of the sport.
So if we wanted to read what you and Levi had to discuss, where would that be?
So it kind of varies, but specifically for Levi, it's on my blog, luke.ellingham.org. But, I mean, over the years it's varied. I've done some stuff for Cycling Illustrated, done some stuff for a site called Daily Peloton. I mean, different interviews happen different places, depending on who wants them and who is actually willing to have me write for them.
You getting paid for some of these?
Nope, not yet. Not a lot of people are interested in hiring a 16-year-old and putting him on a payroll.
Yeah, but what a portfolio you've got, you know?
Yeah. I mean, hopefully one day pay will come, but
sure.
So far, not yet.
Okay. You spoke with ex-UCI head Pat McQuaid. What was that conversation like?
That was an interesting conversation.
I'll bet it was.
I mean, it was just weird. Like, I was really nervous because it's the UCI head. Yeah, I was like 13 and a half at the time.
Oh, geez.
And I was calling him from the States and being like, oh, you know, I want to interview. But, I mean, in the sense of actually, like, an interview, it wasn't, like, hugely different. He's a pretty normal guy. I was expecting him to be a little bit weird, but, you know, he and I talked about, you know, at the time, it was the big thing about the race radio ban and Contador's doping case and stuff like that. So, and we talked about a range of stuff, and it was a fun conversation, but also it was a little bit frightening on my side.
Oh, I think even for me as an adult, I'd be nervous talking with Pat McQuaid. I'm speaking with Luke Allingham. He is a young journalist who writes about the pro peloton. He writes about pro cycling, and he evidently can get interviews with lots of people. I want to know what you're like wanting to interview, who you're wanting to interview next. Who's next on your like your list of, you know, your bucket list of who you're going to interview?
I don't know who's next. I have a couple interviews that I need to get published first because I tend to kind of make the mistake of doing too many at once and then I get myself into a little bit of trouble. But, you know, I don't know. There are guys who I'd really like to interview. Since I started with Leo Partrek, I'd like to interview, like, Andy Schleck one day or Frank Schleck. Who knows if that'll happen, but, you know, it maybe.
What do you think of this year's tour so far?
This year's tour, I really like it.
It's pretty crazy.
It is. I thought, like, the past two tours with Sky have kind of been, like, didn't really like them so much. But this year with Nibali, and, you know, I'm really excited about Thibaut Pinot and Jean-Christophe Perrault and all the French guys, and it's been a really great tour. I'm really looking forward to the final stages here.
Yeah, the next couple of days. You also cover races and teams. Do you travel?
No. Usually it's a lot of bootleg feeds for your sport, and usually it's a lot of, or NBC feeds and stuff like that. Usually it's a lot of like, okay, I'm going to sit down and wake up early in the morning and watch this race, and then I'll report on it.
Do you think U.S. racing is becoming more exciting, more fun?
I do. I mean, Chattanooga was really, really interesting. I missed the time trial. I wasn't there enough in time for the time trial, but the road race was really exciting. It was one of the best races I've watched all year.
What do you think about women's pro racing?
I'm fully on board for it. I'm really excited about the Lac course on the Champs-Élysées this year for them, and they definitely are making progress, which is great to see. I'm really excited for them. I really hope to see some good racing this weekend.
Yeah, I think you will. We were having a conversation earlier about whether Marianne Vos is going to be the shoe-in. We don't know. Who knows?
Yeah, I don't know.
So how much time do you spend researching and writing and interviewing each week?
I don't know. I mean, it's not necessarily per week because, don't do a certain amount of interviews every week. But, I mean, there are definitely times where it's, maybe 15 hours a week of interviews or, researching or trying to contact people and set stuff up. I mean, it takes time, as you probably know, but...
Oh, yeah, I do know.
It takes an insane amount of time.
You know, there are a lot of different things that I've done over the years, and I would say this is probably one of the most time-intensive of all the things. So tell me a little bit about Luke. Where do you go to school?
So I go to school on the north side of Chicago. It's called Amundsen. I'm going into the junior year of high school this year.
Do you think you want to stay with journalism? Is this something that really is, real compelling for you?
You know, I get asked that a lot. And all I can say is, for the time being, I've been doing this for the past 3.5 years, so there's nothing really that's fully caught my attention otherwise. So going into college, unless something changes within the next, year and a half, 2 years, this is probably what I'll be doing, what I'll be studying, what I'll be probably doing in the future.
If I'm not mistaken, Northwestern has an excellent journalism school, right?
Oh, yes.
Yes, that's what I thought. Yeah, I remember that. Well, I think this has been really interesting, and you were right. You were the right person. So I'll tell people how we found out about each other. So I actually put a tweet out on Twitter and said, anybody who's watching the tour who would like to report on it and talk to me, get back to me off Twitter. And you did. And even though we're really not talking about the tour, I find our conversation was just fascinating.
Yes.
I really enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it.
And I wish you a lot of luck. I will follow Luke Allingham, the young journalist, the young cycling journalist. Thank you so much for talking with me this evening.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Good luck. We'll talk again.
All right. Sounds good.
Bye-bye. Luke Allingham joined me from his home in Chicago.
I hope we get to say we knew him when.
Oh, wouldn't that be nice?
And it's always interesting when you hear a 16-year-old kid say, it's a rough game.
It is a rough game.
It is. But it's good to see his enthusiasm and willingness to reach out to, doesn't matter who it is. And
were you doing anything this, together when you were 16?
Gosh, no.
I was driving around with my new driver's license. That was about
it.
Yeah. Well, on that note, we have to say that's the end of our show for this week. We hope you enjoyed it. It was a lot of variety this week, I'd say.
We had a little of everything.
And we did indeed. I hope you have a great week. If you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.